As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. A good time to speak with Michael Darda of MKM Holdings. Michael, I want to work at the nominal basis because that's where our listeners and our viewers are at. Forget about Fed talk. Forget about real inflation. How do we withstand a nominal inflation rate of 8.6%?
Well, Tom, I think this is exactly what you end up getting when you run the nominal economy hot at double-digit growth rates on average since the bottom of the business cycle in 2020. Any look at historical experience will tell you that. And unfortunately for households, if we look at the May data, the proxy for nominal income out of the jobs report, which is essentially just wage growth, hours growth, and employment growth summed together, annualized it at about 10%, all of that being eaten up by inflation with today's report.
That's where I wanted to go, Mike. And that's what I was watching was real average hourly earnings, both on an hourly as well as a weekly basis. On a weekly basis, it is now the most negative that it's been in data going back to 2006, negative 3.9% in terms of how far behind wage inflation is falling behind the actual stuff we buy every day. What does this do to your growth outlook, Mike?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, you know, we're dealing with a little bit of a stagflationary environment here, at least for the month of May. So obviously, we've had some intensifying shocks in food and energy prices. So hopefully, at some point, that will reverse. But, you know, as Mike McKee went into, this is an inflationary process that has been broadening and deepening out. So you've got pressure on rental inflation, that's a significant portion of the CPI. If we look at services inflation, excluding energy, that's 60% of the CPI, it's running at more than double the average of the last business cycle. So it might be a bit of a fool's errand here to just assume that if crude oil prices back off, all of a sudden a magic wand is waved and the inflation problem simply goes away.
Mike, we thought that we had seen peak inflation. We had not. We now have an even higher print that is a new post-1981 high. Is 8.6% the high watermark, or are we going to see even higher ahead?
Well, I think we're probably pretty close to peak inflation on a year-over-year basis, but none of that may matter for the path of Fed tightening and the bond market and equity market valuations, because if inflation eases from here but still stays very high, then you know that is not an environment where the Fed just moves to the sidelines and we see some kind of huge revaluation and expensive equities that dominate the market cap of the S&P 500. So there are some macro commentators making kind of bizarre arguments, at least from my perspective, that aren't focused sufficiently on the nominal GDP backdrop, which is still way too strong. Aggregate demand is still way too strong. So the Fed has more work to do. And the fact that if inflation eases but is settling in at rates that are several times the Fed's target, acceptable inflation over time, then that's still going to be a problem for the bond market and a problem for the Federal Reserve.
Well, and, you know, Mohamed El-Erian, who was on yesterday with John Farrow, said, if you think we're going to have a recession, sure, inflation's going to come down, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that's not what you want to see, right? That's not how transitory inflation should be affected. So is that the way we're going to see it?
Well, Matt, I think, unfortunately, eventually that's where we probably end up. But the critical discussion is timing there. So I don't think that we're in a recession now, and I don't see a recession this year. I think the recession will come after the Fed gets itself into a restrictive monetary posture. And that's going to take some time. Consider this fact. Forget the backward-looking numbers that we just got, as shocking as they are. The Fed funds rate relative to 5-year expected inflation is still below 200 basis points, minus 200 basis points. And that is below the trough of the last business cycle, when you had very slow growth and, you know, in very weak realized inflation. And so this Fed is still behind the curve, and that is going to create a situation where these underlying drivers, inflation, like services and rents and wages, are likely to continue accelerating.
Well, Michael Dart, that's right where I wanted to go, because frankly, folks, the most important inflation data of the day after this shock is at 10 a.m. with a five-year forward Michigan statistic. Michael Dart, what are the ramifications to the economic zeitgeist if we get the five-year Michigan look to break out above 3%, to break out of the inflation level of 2006?
Yeah, I think the FOMC would take note of that. You know, those measures are a bit stickier than the bond market break-even measures, but, you know, they are elevated marginally relative to their averages of the last cycle. And if we start to see any kind of what looks like a breakout, I think that would create a lot of consternation on the FOMC that these high headline inflation numbers are bleeding into longer term expectations. And, you know, I think the Fed would be alarmed by that.
Michael Darda, thank you so much for the insight. Michael Darda, MKM Partners. I can't say enough about his linkage of the equity markets into what we see in economics. This was scheduled before the inflation report and the importance of it. David Harrow, of course, always looking at price change across America. But far more, we've tried to get David Harrow on of Harris Associates to speak of EU banking. It has been an absolute shock. And David, I've got to start with Credit Suisse and the view back, I'm going to say 15 years or so, before the great financial crisis of 2006. And it has been an abject value trap and an abject failure. You've been directly involved in this. You have been patient. David Harrow, have you run out of patience with the gnomes of failure in Zurich?
Well, not at this stage yet, because there has been wholesale changes at the bank from the board to the management down. And I think we need to see what the new people who are involved with the bank, both from the executive management committee and the board of directors, can do to turn this around. There is inherent value within the business, and I think these people should be given a chance to try to create this value and sustain this value. The bank trades at about a third or 40% of book value.
Right.
So the object now should be stabilization, and then growth after stabilization. And if, you know, if they can't do it, someone else has to.
Do they have a Swiss put? Are they not making tough decisions because they know this government has their back, that Zurich will be UBS and that Zurich will be Credit Suisse?
I would hope not, by the way. I'm a believer in free market capitalism, and there shouldn't be any protection. If they can't do it and someone comes in to make an acquisition to all or parts of the business, I think that should be allowed to happen. Now, there's talk that if someone does bid, they will give UBS a chance to do some kind of a deal combination. But I would certainly hope that is not the case.
Is Europe even ready for big cross-border bank M&A?
I don't think you can have cross-border bank M&A in Europe on a wide scale until some of the rules and laws are changed. At some point, this may happen, but you still have fragmented banking markets, which it makes it non-conducive to cross-border. I think there is a possibility for some on an isolated levels and basis, but at this stage, you still need regulatory evening out that would make it more conducive to cross-border M&A. On the other hand, a company like Credit Suisse has a huge private wealth management business, which is now bigger than their global markets investment banking business. And for any big global bank that wants exposure in this lucrative area, you would think Credit Suisse would be an attractive asset.
I got to ask you about China, because every morning, it seems like futures lately are driven by the idea that China may get a little bit lighter on tech companies. Yesterday, there was a report that Ant could revive its IPO, although that's been kind of poo-pooed. I see that you own a stake in Prosus, which in turn owns a stake in Tencent, right? What's your view on China tech?
Yeah, it does appear that we've hit peak regulatory initiatives in China. As you know, over the last year or so, they've been increasing a regulatory scrutiny on the Chinese tech sector. So the whole sector has been kind of hit. We also own some Alibaba as well, and both these sectors have been hit. But we believe that even with this additional regulatory scrutiny, now keep in mind what's happened is these businesses around the globe have grown much faster than the regulators' ability around the globe to regulate them. And China's kind of taken a first stab. But what we have seen, what appears to be statements from the government that were getting to the end of the regulatory initiatives. And then you even saw in the case of Tencent, lots of games that were approved this week. This is one of the things that they were concerned about, withholding game approvals, for the various reasons. So we are starting to see regulatory relief, or at least movements by the government that the worst is behind the sector. Right. And meanwhile, these are really well-run, world-class tech right. companies that trade at low double-digit multiples.
David Harrow, thank you so much. Too brief a visit, but we've got so much going on in inflation. David Harrow of Harris Associates there.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Jonathan Golub is having a difficult Friday. He's at Credit Suisse and, of course, their chief U.S. equity strategist. John, I've got to get out in front of your research note. Will you amend your targets this weekend for Monday trading?
No, we won't amend our target. And I think, you know, our call all along is that the inflation is going to be stickier at a much higher level. And we've been recommending companies that benefit from higher inflation. So there's two ways of thinking about this. Today's report is bad for the market in general, but there are certain companies that hold up better or worse in a higher inflation environment than others, and that's right. where we're focusing.
John Golub, what's so important to me here is the behavior, and I don't mean to harken back to the fossildom that I am in the 1970s, but let's look at the deck of cards. We've got the worst bond market since time began, price down, yield up. We've got these inflation numbers today, the Fed parlor game that we're going to see out to the end of the year. What do you and the Credit Suisse Securities research team feel corporations will do? In my estimation, they have to rapidly act even into June and July and make the plans that they thought they would make come October. Am I right on that?
You know, Tom, I don't think you are right on that.
Okay.
I think that companies in a very high nominal GDP environment, which is what we have, the underlying economy, for all the recession concerns, is fine. Revenues are rip-roaring strong, and so bigger companies in this environment have tended to do a bit of a better job of being able to maintain costs. But profits are really high. The thing which is getting smacked around, Tom, are the stock multiples, not the earnings. And that's important to think about.
So what kind of multiple do you think is right for this market, especially if the Fed has a terminal rate of 3.5%?
Well, first of all, I think that the Fed is going to, and I think this is going to lead the dialogue, that this conversation that we were having over the last couple of weeks, can the Fed pause in September? Well, we know that the answer to that now is no. And the Fed probably has to move beyond 3.5%. But we still have a very powerful earnings environment. The revisions, the analyst adjustment to the earnings, with all the discussion that we've been having about weak earnings, they're going up almost every day. So we think that the market.
So how much should investors be paying for forward earnings?
If you look at a corporate bond yield, which is what your discount rate, it's not Fed funds, it's still something like 5%, which is a low number. So we think that stocks are attractively valued at these levels, and we would be going in. The level of concern in the market is much higher than the underlying backdrop.
CIBC reported, and this is Catherine Judge reporting from CIBC Toronto. And folks, I think this really sums it up. CIBC calls this inflation report red hot. And they go, Matt Miller, right to the heart of the matter, which McKee alluded to, which is shelter is the most gain since 2004. We've been highlighting this today, folks, from Senator Manchin's Charleston, West Virginia, to Senator Miller's suburb north of New York. I mean, Matt Miller, this is nothing that anybody already knows. We are aware of this.
I mean, if you look at the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller, we should really ask Bob to shorten that. If you look at their 20-city index and max it out, we're at a level that towers over what we saw in 2004, 2005. So in terms of the absolute level, it's just unbelievable the amount of appreciation you've seen in house prices.
John Golub with Credit Suisse with us here. John, you talk about the animal spirit of nominal GDP, but at 8.6% headline, is there a point where the inflation price change part of nominal absolutely overwhelms actual economic growth?
That's like the ultimate question. Like I said before, the earnings are fine. The stock multiple is in five multiple points is a decline in stock multiples this year. Today's news taken by itself should push the multiple down. The market, the futures are down something like 1.25% on this news. That is that's exactly what you'd expect to happen. But the market has already adjusted, enormously for this inflation environment. So I think that the market probably has taken all the bad news into account already, which is one of the reasons why I'm not as concerned, not because this isn't a good report, but because the market's already discounted a ton of bad news. And most importantly, a red hot, and you're just talking about the CIBC report, a red hot economy does not equal recession. And this is a red-hot economy, not a recessionary economy.
John Golub, thank you so much. Right now, Ellen Wall joins us. I can't say enough about her book, Saudi Inc. It is a window into the layers of the Ibn Saud family, the heritage of the family, and most importantly, the new family. She's senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. I guess Mr. Biden will visit Riyadh. It's not formally announced yet, but there it is, Ellen, as well. When he visits, can there be a belief that Saudi Arabia can adjust the price of a gallon of gas in America?
I think that if you have that belief still, you need to re-examine your belief system, because Saudi Arabia does not have the ability to change the price of a gallon of gasoline like that unless they do something so incredibly drastic. And at this point, even with demand the way it is and with other producers kind of falling right off a cliff, even if Saudi Arabia put another 2 million barrels a day of oil on the market, I don't think we would even see that much of a drop in U.S. gasoline prices.
The hope and prayer here, Ellen, is a redux of OPEC 1, OPEC 2, 1986. And there was that moment in 1986 where oil cratered. Can we relive that?
Well, we could. I mean, we almost relived that in, if you remember, in March of 2020, when just as global oil demand was cratering, Russia and Saudi Arabia both kind of opened their taps. So and saw in April and May of that year an incredible amount of oil just flooding the market and crashing prices. I don't think that we are likely to see a redux of that in this case unless there's some sort of major shock to the global economy that mm-hmm. causes demand to crater. At this point, we're so tight in supply, and there's enough Russian oil that has been off the market. There's a question about whether it's really coming back or not. I think that it's coming back a little bit more than people think, but still demand has just been so high, and with China reopening and demand expected to go up there, it's really just, it seems like there really isn't enough oil in production now in the world to get that, to get these prices down significantly. And then when you throw in, the situation in Ukraine and Russia, it's just a recipe for prices to keep rising.
Ellen, the people who say this is a policy error and we should have been investing more in fossil fuels, if there were some sort of change in policy that would encourage more investment, how long would it take before those barrels would actually come online to ramp up production?
So it would definitely take some time. You know, we're not Saudi Arabia. We don't just have spare capacity that can come online that quickly. But it's not as slow as it would take in other areas, because there are shale oil resources that can come online, you know, within a month, 2 months, 3 months, things like that. Longer term, though, we would need a lot of investment in big long-term projects, say in the Gulf of Mexico and other areas that could pump a substantial amount of oil that would bring down prices in the long term. You'd have that.
Ellen, why would those executives want to do that kind of investment? I mean, they've been vilified by not only this administration, but by the U.S. Congress. Why make that kind of long-term investment when you know that policies and regulations can change on a dime against you?
Precisely. I mean, this is the question. You know, if you're an oil and gas executive and you're responsible for making decisions about the health of the company, returning value to your shareholders, of course you're not going to want to make any of these long-term investments, because you are concerned that any project that you invest in could just either get shut down by government regulations, or for all you know, they're finally going to issue the methane regulations and you're just going to have to spend a huge amount more money to comply. That uncertainty, I think, is really keeping production from increasing.
On the flip side, Ellen, how much can some of the renewable sources of energy start to offset fossil fuel usage in a way that is more material in the near term and, frankly, expedite that transition?
Look, I don't want to be a downer about wind and solar, because I think they are great technologies and they're improving all the time. But if you look at the amount of energy you get from renewable energy and you compare it to the amount of energy you get from breaking down a hydrocarbon, you just can't compare it. You need so much more of these renewable sources in order to compensate for hydrocarbons. I mean, we're at a point where energy use is still increasing. And so all of the renewables that are coming online are helping to create that, to offset that new demand, forget replacing old sources.
Ellen Wald, very quickly here, I have a moving average of inflation-adjusted Brent, which tells me that when we get up to $140 a barrel, things change. How will our behavior change if we see Brent move 124 up to 140?
And you know what? If you'd asked me a month ago whether we'd get there, I'd say, well, 140 is a long way off. Now it doesn't seem so far away. I think that if we hit 140 Brent, we're definitely going to see a lot of people and also businesses too making decisions to not expand, maybe cut back on production. We're already seeing businesses say that depend on petroleum products. We saw Lululemon earlier this week say, hey, we're raising the prices of our products because they are made from petroleum, and petroleum is just that much more expensive. Yeah. So it's not just relying on energy, it's also every business that uses oil products.
Interesting. Ellen Wall, thank you for the brief on oil with the Atlantic Council. Can't say enough about weekend reading with Saudi Inc. as well. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.